and welcome to In the News on Chris. I'm Rick Anderson, your science guy, who's going to be reading stories from the June 19th, 2024 edition of the New York Times Science section. Our first story says, get ready for the longest day of the year in the Northern Hemisphere. We have Earth's off-kilter tilt to thank for the summer solstice, as well as the different seasons. The story is by Katrina Miller. On June 20th, everyone in the northern half of our planet will experience the summer solstice. It'll be the longest day of the year north of the equator, and it is the scientific start of summer. Earth has a solstice every 6 months, in June and in December. Leading up to the summer solstice, the sun appears in a higher spot in the sky at the same time each day until it reaches its maximum point. After the summer solstice, the days will get shorter. The sun will appear lower in the sky each day until the winter solstice on December 21st. And what time is the actual solstice? Well, according to the National Weather Service, the summer solstice would occur on Thursday at 4:51 p.m. Eastern Time. This is moment during the day when the sun reaches its northernmost point in the sky during the year. Why do we have solstices? The sun's height in the sky each day changes, because Earth spins on its axis, which is tilted 23.5 degrees away from the vertical. This means that depending on the time of the year, the hemisphere leans either toward or away from the sun. This is what gives Earth its seasons. When the northern half of the planet leans toward the sun, it experiences summer. At the same time, the southern half of the planet leans away from the sun, and it is in winter. It is a mystery why Earth angled this way, though some astronomers believe that its tilt paved the way for life to exist. In the northern hemisphere, the summer solstice happens when Earth's tilt toward the sun is greatest. Despite this, the hottest temperatures of the year usually occur a few weeks later, in July or August, because it takes time for the sun's rays to warm our planet. Do other planets in our solar system have solstices? Well, any planet that is tilted will have solstices. According to NASA, every planet in our solar system has an axial tilt, but some are more pronounced than others. Venus and Jupiter have only slight leans around 3 degrees, while Mercury, at 0.03 degrees, is barely slanted at all. On the other hand, Uranus is a whopping 97.8 degrees from vertical, causing one of its poles to point directly at the sun at times. That extreme tilt causes it to have some of the most dramatic seasons in our solar system. Saturn and Neptune both have tilts close to Earth's. So does Mars at 25.2 degrees, although the red planet's tilt has shifted dramatically over millions of years. How do people celebrate the summer solstice? Well, every year, people around the world ring in the June solstice with midsummer bonfires, festivals, and, for those living above the Arctic Circle, midnight sun celebrations. At the other end of the world, scientists living in Antarctica throw their annual midwinter feast to commemorate the longest, darkest night on the continent. Others travel to ancient ruins like Stonehenge in England or the Temple of the Sun in Peru to greet the solstice sun the way ancient peoples did. And we turn now to our next story, which says the Titan disaster forces global rethinking of deep sea exploration. A year after the first deaths of divers who ventured into the ocean's sunless depths, An industry wrestles with new challenges for piloted submersibles and robotic explorers. The story is by William J. Broad. When five men died on June 18, 2023, in the implosion of the Titan submersible during a dive to the Titanic's resting place, the knowledge of Paul-Henri Nargileau was lost too. It was Mr. Nargileau's 38th dive to the sunken liner. Known as Mr. Titanic, he helped retrieve thousands of artifacts that have been displayed in museums and at events around the world. 1 year later, the company he worked for as director of underwater research is preparing a July expedition that will employ a pair of robots instead of people in submersibles looking for more treasures to bring up in the future. Jessica Sanders, president of the RMS Titanic, which is organizing the expedition, said, "There's an art to artifact recovery and a human element that technology can never replace, and shouldn't." She said Mr. Nargileau had embodied that kind of expertise. On the other hand, she said the results of the robotic expedition will speak for themselves. The plans of Mr. Nargileau's former employers show one of the more immediate effects of the Titan disaster: a prioritization of robots for plying the icy depths in place of humans piloting submersibles. The robots are seen as safer. In parallel, however, players in the submersible world are pushing for greater international regulation to bar another disaster. They want to close the gap that OceanGate, Titan's maker, exploited in issuing the voluntary safety certification the industry uses to reduce the substantial risks for deep divers. The many fans of human-piloted submersibles want to make sure that Mr. Nargileau's legacy sets a path for a new generation of explorers. That could include future human pilots who recover more of Titanic's remains and paraphernalia. Rivets, fine china, bottles of champagne, that lie scattered roughly over 3 square miles of the North Atlantic seabed. On his last dive, Mr. Nargileau hoped to glimpse one of his lifetime recovery targets, the wireless telegraph that transmitted Titanic's distress calls. Responding ships rescued hundreds of survivors, including women and children, in lifeboats. In his autobiography, Mr. Nargileau said, "Titanic wreckage around the famous telegraph is likely to collapse in the short term, making its rescue all the more urgent." James Cameron, known for Titanic, his 1997 movie, also favors the telegraph's retrieval. "To actually put that instrument on public display would be very moving for millions of museum goers," he said in an interview last year. In 1987, when Mr. Nargileau made his first Titanic dive, underwater robots were rare. Then Cold War spin-offs caused their abilities and their numbers to soar. Robert D. Crist of the Marine Technology Society, an industry group, said they now number in the thousands, and that perhaps 100 or so could descend to the Titanic's depths more than 2 miles down. Large undersea robots bristle with lights, computers, video cameras, mapping systems, sensors, and manipulator arms. Most of them have long tethers that link them to mother ships. Up top, the operators use joysticks and monitors to orchestrate the action below. The July expedition to the Titanic, which lies roughly 370 miles off Newfoundland, Canada, is to feature 2 diving machines from the Chouest Group, a family of companies based in Louisiana that services the offshore oil industry. In May, it announced the acquisition of another company, which expanded its undersea fleet to more than 100 robots. I've been puzzled for a number of years why anybody even builds deep submersibles anymore. Tyler Schilling, an industry pioneer who founded the Schilling Robotics in Davis, California, said, referring to human-piloted craft, "I think the tightness situation is the only reasonable answer. People want the adventure. The adventure factor, submersible backers say, is real and healthy because it helps generate wide appreciation among the public for the wonders of the world's oceans. A new generation of human-piloted submersibles is seen as enhancing the allure. Known as bubble subs, they have spherical hulls of clear plastic, which give their occupants stunning panoramic views instead of glimpses through tiny portholes. A bubble sub strong enough to withstand the crushing pressures at the Titanic's depth is now taking shape. Triton Submarines, a company in Sebastian, Florida, is fashioning the sub for Larry Connor, an Ohio billionaire and ocean adventurer. Triton says it will set a record for how deep a bubble submarine can descend. The new submersible is intended to show the world that, contrary to last year's disaster, undersea craft can venture safely and repeatedly to the Titanic's depth. 100 years ago, such a thing wasn't possible, Patrick Leahy, the president of Triton Submarines, said of the new sub. But technological strides, he added, allow us to do it safely. For instance, Mr. Leahy said steady advances in the heating and shaping of thermoplastic materials will let Triton make the clear walls of the submersible incredibly strong. Their thickness, he said, will be 16 inches, a record. Mr. Leahy added that the two-person craft to make its oceanic debut in early 2026. Triton is a company priding itself on what the Titan submersible lacked: costly rounds of inspection and testing by respected marine organizations that specialize in certifying deep undersea craft as safe. It's an industry-wide code of conduct now that experts see as needing to become a global requirement because Titan's makers omitted the voluntary step. It has to be mandatory. Alfred S. McLaren, a retired Navy submariner and submersible pilot and president emeritus of the Explorers Club, said of the proposed upgrade, "Until you get these testing and certification rules in place, it's a wide open sea, and stupid things are going to happen." Will Conan, who chairs the Submarine Committee of the Marine Technology Society, agreed. "We have the technology down pat," he said. "We don't need to prove that we're safe. What we need is the regulatory framework that will control the traffic and check to see if people have their driver's licenses." Mr. Conan said, "About 200 submersibles piloted by people now ply the world's oceans, a tiny fraction of the deep robot population, and that only 10 or so could descend to Titan's depth. Until the Titan disaster, submersibles had a remarkable safety record because companies adhered to the voluntary code. Despite thousands of deep dives, no person in a submersible ever died while plunging into the ocean's sunless depths. Experts say it is likely that governmental investigations into what caused the Titan implosion will need to be concluded before new submersible rules are drafted." This month, the head of the American investigation, Captain Jason D. Neubauer of the Coast Guard, said his inquiry's conclusions and the making of its findings public might take another year or two. The International Maritime Organization, the United Nations agency that sets standards for marine safety and security, has stated that it is waiting for such findings before taking up the global question of submersible regulation. people will embrace the change, Salvatore Mercogliano, a maritime historian at the Campbell University of North Carolina, said of a new regulation. Everybody has safety on their mind. After the Titan disaster, echoing the new caution, RMS Titanic decided to pause its reliance on piloted craft until further investigation takes place on the implosion's cause. Ms. Sanders, the president of RMS Titanic, said new confidence in submersible safety would let her company again employ piloted vehicles, in particular for the daunting task of retrieving the telegraph that sent out Titanic's distress calls. An early version of the recovery plan called for a piloted vehicle to work with three robots in an expedition to recover the legendary device. With both robots and submersibles, Ms. Sanders said her company's overall goal is to make sure that gems from the storied liner are not lost to the sea for a second time. We turn now to our next story that asks, more than 1,000 birds died one night in Chicago. Will it happen again? A mass of birds died in Chicago in October after striking one building, adding to the push for more protections in one of the most dangerous cities for avian migration. The story is by Amanda Hallpook. One night in October, an enormous swirl of birds flew over Chicago, astounding those who had their binoculars trained on the flashes of yellow, white, and brown speckling the sky above. It seemed like an incredible moment for birders, but the next day ended with nearly 1,000 dead birds outside one building along Lake Michigan, and even more scattered across the city streets. Migration experts said the unusual mass deaths were the product of a number of common occurrences happening all at once. One factor, they said, was easily preventable: the number of buildings that had their lights on, which disoriented birds that were migrating overnight on October 4th. Since October, there have been significant changes at the building where the highest concentration of birds died. McCormick Place Lakeside Center, but advocates for bird safety are seeking measures that protect birds across the city. These measures include treating windows with film that is more visible to birds, using shutters or drapes to block windows, and turning off decorative lighting at night during migration seasons. Judy Pollock, president of the Chicago Bird Alliance, said that the changes at McCormick's Place were excellent. There's a lot of other buildings that need to do something about their windows. She's the Chicago Bird Collision Monitors, a volunteer group that recovers dead birds and helps those that are injured, found 1,600 dead or injured birds in a downtown area smaller than 2 square miles on October 5th, said the group's director, Annette Prince. Ms. Prince said thousands of additional birds could have died or even been hurt in the city, because the group does not reach out in every area, and birds may have struck other buildings after the volunteers left. Chicago has some of the highest migration traffic in the country because its location in the center of the United States. It was named, along with Houston and Dallas, as one of the most dangerous cities for migrating birds in an April 2019 study published in the journal Frontiers in Ecology and the Environment. For years, bird safety advocates have tried to get Chicago to pass an ordinance similar to one in New York City that would require new buildings to be safe for birds. The ultimate goal is to make bird safety a requirement for all new buildings, new and old. In April, the Chicago Department of Planning and Development unveiled a draft of its sustainable development policy that included updated bird protection standards. Those would be voluntary and not mandatory. The policy is expected to be implemented in the coming months. We feel that Chicago poses such a great threat to the birds, Ms. Prince said, and yet they continue to stall on taking action. The voluntary standards include protecting areas of a building that are especially susceptible to bird strikes. such as glass railings, decorative panels, and awnings, with materials like decals or wood that birds can see better than highly reflective or transparent materials. The standards also encourage buildings to have a minimum of 20 feet between glass walls and exterior pools or fountains, and to be able to control decorative lighting so that it can be turned off between 11 p.m. and daylight during migration seasons. Tenants of buildings on the higher floors would also be encouraged to turn out lights or draw blinds after 11 p.m., the guidance said. Peter Stravobatsko, a deputy commissioner of Chicago's Department of Planning and Development, said in an email that mandatory standards would require city council legislation. The sustainable development policy gives points to new developments based on what sustainability standards they use to reach a required threshold. The 2024 update places higher value on bird protection than before. Planning Department recognizes that Chicago's location along a major flyway poses a hazard for migrating birds, Mr. Stravobosco said. The department expects that increasing the point value of bird protections would encourage more developments to adopt them. About 10% of projects have chosen bird protections in the past, he said. During this year's spring migration, more than 54.7 million birds flew over Chicago, and there were no mass death events like one last fall. In the days before, some birders called the Chicago megaflight, the winds had been bad for migrations, so large number of birds waited outside the city for conditions to improve, said Benjamin Van Doren, an assistant professor at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, who studies migratory animals. He was involved in the 2019 study about the dangerous cities of migration. Once the weather became safe to fly in outside the city, a huge concentration of birds headed south and encountered intense thunderstorms. As the birds flew lower to avoid the storm and find land, they faced hazards including Lake Michigan and the city's bright buildings. Another hazard, McCormick Place Lakeside Center, an event center along the shores of Lake Michigan that is covered in about 2 football fields worth of glass. The building was lit for an event when the collisions happened, and nearly 1,000 birds were found dead outside. David Willard, a retired collection manager of the bird collection at the Field Museum in Chicago, who has been monitoring bird strikes at McCormick Place since 1978, making the building an unusually fertile source for studying risks to birds. During the migration season, Dr. Willard and another museum representative will walk the perimeter of the building around dawn searching for birds that have struck the building. The Field Museum has collected more than 40,000 dead birds over the years and helped between 4,000 and 4,500 stunned birds. Dr. Willard said in more than 4 decades his team had never found as many birds as it did that day in October. Birds were still hitting the building well after dawn, he said. It was almost like you could have put a brick wall in front of them and they would still have hit it, he said. The 977 birds killed were mostly warblers, Dr. Willard said. Most common type found was the palm warbler, of which there were more than 300, followed by the yellow-rumped warbler. Among other birds were also soras, indigo buntings, and wood thrushes. Another 100 birds were found stunned and were later released away from the building. After the bird deaths, representatives from McCormick Place joined Dr. Willard on his perimeter walk. The building owners have also consulted bird experts, including those at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Loretta Clark, the chief executive of the Metropolitan Pier and Exposition Authority, the municipal corporation that owns McCormick Place, said the authority was planning to install window film that creates a pattern that birds can see. The film will cost about $1.2 million, Ms. Clark said, and the authority is aiming to have it installed by the fall migration season. The group also considered buying motorized drapes and blinds, but decided that was too costly. Ms. Clark said the building also participate in the Lights Out program, a campaign that calls on buildings across the country to turn off or dim lights at night during migration seasons. At McCormick Place, drapes are closed for the entire day on windows that have them, and when an event is over and the people have left, the lights are dimmed to 25%. Dr. Van Doren said policies that reduce or eliminate light from buildings were a simple way to reduce bird deaths. It's a really big issue, but it's also an issue that with concerted effort, we can easily tackle and have immediate impact, he said. And in our final story, Voyager 1, after major malfunction, is back from the brink, NASA says. The farthest man-made object in space had been feared lost forever after a computer problem in November effectively rendered the 46-year-old probe useless. The story is by Orlando Meyerquin. Several months after a grave computer problem seemed to spell the end for Voyager 1, which for nearly a half century had provided data on the outer planets and the far reaches of the solar system, NASA announced recently that it had restored the spacecraft to working order. The spacecraft has resumed gathering information about interstellar space, NASA said in its announcement about Voyager 1, the farthest man-made object in space. Since the problem surfaced in November, engineers have been working to diagnose and resolve the issue, a tedious and lengthy process complicated by the fact that it takes almost 2 days to send and receive information from Voyager 1, which was the first man-made object ever to enter interstellar space and is currently more than 15 billion miles from Earth. The space community had been holding its breath since last year, as the prospect of fixing the aging probe appeared as dire as ever. In February, Susan Dodd, the Voyager Mission Project Manager, said the problem, which hindered Voyager 1's ability to send coherent engineering and science data back to Earth, was the most serious issue the probe had faced since she began leading the mission in 2010. Voyager 1 and its twin probe, Voyager 2, were launched in 1977 on a mission to explore the outer planet. NASA capitalized on a rare alignment in the solar system, which enabled the probes to visit 4 other planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, by using the gravity of each to swing to the next. At its planetary mission, a success, Voyager 1 continued its journey toward the edge of the solar system, and in 1990 it snapped a fabled photo of the Earth, a tiny speck in an infinite darkness that became known as the pale blue dot. In 2012, the probe became the first to cross into interstellar space and had since, along with its twin, which followed 6 years later, collected data about the heliosphere, the space around the sun directly under the sun's influence. Perhaps as profound as the pale blue dot, each spacecraft is equipped with a golden phonograph record loaded with sound recordings and images showing humanity and life on Earth begging to one day be discovered by another civilization. The outlook for recovering Voyager 1 improved substantially in April when NASA reported that it had managed to get the probe to send back usable data about its engineering systems and its health. That was followed by new news late last month that the team had restored functionality to 2 of Voyager's science instruments, allowing it to send back science data and continue its mission. The agency announced that it had brought the remaining instruments back online and restored Voyager 1 to its normal operations. Still, Voyager 1's new lease on life may not last very long. NASA had previously estimated that the nuclear-powered generators on Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 were likely to die around 2025. And that's all the time we have for today. This has been Rick Anderson, your science guy, who has been reading stories from the June 19th, 2024 edition of the New York Times Science section. Thanks for listening, and hey, let's do this again next week.